Right now, that's what I'm saying. They have the right now to make their pitch and sign.
Order, we have a quorum. We have Representative Willis, Representative Ivan, Representative Green, Representative Porter, and myself. First item on the agenda is House Bill 345, Pension Board Investment Procurements by Representative Foster, and we have staff here to present the bill. Please go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you for hearing the bill. My name is John Walsh. I'm staff to Representative Foster, and he asked that I present this for him this morning. House Bill 345 is an act relating to the procurement of investments and brokerage services by the Alaska State Pension Investment Board. House Bill 345 simply requires that the Pension Investment Board increase the utilization of brokerage and investment services provided by persons located in the state to at least 7% of the brokerage service procured by the board. Additionally, there is a provision to allow the board to opt out of this if they have a written finding or upon a written finding that the goal couldn't be met or the services are not available or they decline to use the services for a particular reason. So a written finding would allow them to opt out of that 7%, but the requirement that the legislation would ask that 7% be used through the local investment services. And sort of in support of the bill, there are numerous people that wish to testify, so I'm going to keep my presentation short and allow them to talk about the legislation from their point of view. The findings of the legislation indicate our support that there is a need for a healthy, competitive private sector, the need to review state procurement practices and support a local procurement process. This is not uncommon for efforts of the legislature to increase local activity and bidder's preferences and other state bid awards. And most importantly, for all state agencies and state resources to be directed towards improving the state economy. We all talk of a fiscal gap. Past practices have gotten our state into a dependence on state and federal government services, and I think it's time that we begin to look at all resources of the state and consider how we could apply them best to improve the economy in the state and help for softening the landing, if you will, or continuing with a 20 and 40 year horizon of a stable economy here in the state. And certainly the treasuries or the worth of these funds are considerable, and the use of these funds in the state through very professional scrutiny of the investments is not unreasonable. And for the record, it is the intent of the sponsor that that this legislation is to enhance the funds as opposed to in any way jeopardize the integrity of the funds. So we do not wish to diminish the investment integrity in any way by requesting that they use Alaskan services, and nor do we think that they would. So with that, Madam Chair, I would like to hear some of the testimony from members that have signed up, and I'll stand by in the back of the room if there are questions or if you'd like to bring me back to the table.
Okay, is there anyone who has any questions or comments before we go to testimony?
Thank you,
ma'am. Then the first one that is signed in to speak here in Juno, do we have anybody on teleconference on this bill? Do we know? But in Juno here we have Jim Crawford. There's a little list of things you need to say before you begin your testimony, Mr. Crawford, and let's try to keep your testimony from 2 to 3 minutes if possible. I know that's difficult, but we have a huge schedule of things today, and people want to testify, so we have to kind of share and share alike.
Okay, I can just pass those down.
In?
Yes.
Oh.
Thank you. My name is Jim Crawford. My address is 9521 Spring Hill Drive in Anchorage. My phone number is area code 907-563-9683. My employer is City Commerce Corporation. I'm the president and CEO. I'd like to just take you through a couple things as far as in-state investments and why this program can be very effective for building the economy of the state. If you look at the first chart, that's our employment, and that's really how you judge an economy on a statewide basis, I think, as you look at employment over a long period of time. I think there's a lot of misperceptions about Alaska's economy and therefore the stability of in-state investment. But if you look at it from statehood through that period, it's a continual climb. Obviously, there are recessions as there are in any state, and you can see those. The next one is employment trends. What we did was we compared Alaska, Texas, California, and New York, and I think significant in that is the trend line on Alaska is much more positive than any of the other states that we looked at, Texas, California, and New York. Also, the employment actual on a statewide basis, Alaska, Texas, California, New York, there's been much said about the cyclical nature of Alaska's economy. Alaska does have a cyclical economy. I guess that's the bad news. The good news is every other state does too. So it compares very favorably with other states. The housing trend line is the most positive. We compared Anchorage, Dallas, Los Angeles, and New York. We did that because pension funds are currently making investments in those areas, and we see those areas as having a greater risk for pension funds and the permanent fund than Anchorage does. And the last one is one that permanent fund put out, which shows the oil income versus the investment income of the state. Now, if you compare the policy of Washington State, and the next handout I gave you is on what other pension funds do. Washington State cut back their allocation for real estate invested in their region from 78% to 44%. That compares with PERS and TERS at zero. Washington State invests in their own region and in their own state. Oregon puts mortgage money into Oregon alone. Texas, the teachers' retirement system in Texas, puts 50% of their entire fund into real estate and half of that into Texas. So there's a pattern of other states as far as the state retirement systems supporting the local economy and doing so safely with equality and with an excellent return. The last item that I'd like to give you is this is a discussion. Obviously, we don't have time to get into it right now, but it's a discussion of Alaska's quality investment versus, and it's based on capitalization rates. And finally, connecting Alaska to long-term money, and we've been blackballed as a state for a long time, as far as long-term goes. What this last sheet does is it tells you that you can reduce rents in this state by about 15% simply by converting to long-term money for the apartment complexes that are out there versus what we have today. Alaska's apartments and commercial buildings are financed on short-term loans with short amortization and higher interest rates, about 2.5% higher than what it would be to finance something in Seattle or Dallas or Los Angeles or New York City. So from my perspective, this legislation, I'd ask you to pass it on to the Senate Finance. I think it can be a critical component of expanding the local economy, expanding the small business capability, done safely and done with expertise. So.
Thank you. Is there any questions with this testimony? Not. Thank you very much for coming forward. Next, we have Merritt Olson. You don't want to testify?
I think
so. Okay, thank you, sir. David Schwantes.
Good morning.
Please try to keep your testimony between 2 and 3 minutes, please.
It'll be fine. My name is David Schwantes, S-C-H-W-A-N-T-E-S, 8148 East 4th Avenue in Anchorage, Alaska. My phone number is 333-1327, and I am a retired teacher. I guess I want to speak against the bill for a couple of reasons. First of all, I can't find anything in the bill now that isn't allowed, and if the people wish to make a presentation to the board and the board feels that it can do business with them, then they're allowed to do that at this point, and to require them to invest 7% of the funds in Alaska, to me, is a disservice to the people that they represent. We have an elected board, pension board, to do the best job they can do. And I assume that if a presentation is made and the board feels that it's a good presentation and can do the best job for the people, that they'll do that. The one thing that bothers me is the last part of the statement that says unless the board makes a written finding that the board is unable to meet the goal because there's insufficient number of persons with the required skills. The thing that bothers me is there are a lot of people that have skills to do things, but do they provide the best quality that there is? And I think that if the board hears the testimony and they think that that's the best quality for the people that the pension board serves, then they would accept that. And if it's not the best, then they would go in and do their investing someplace else. But they may have the skills to do the job, and that would, if this bill passes, then that would require that the board use that particular investment, even though there may be better ones. And so from that standpoint, I'm opposed to the bill and would urge the people who want to do this in Alaska to come before the board and do the job, make the presentation, and hopefully if the board feels it's good, they'll accept it.
I have a question. I'm surprised to hear testimony. And I guess that one of the reasons that I'm surprised is because what I hear out in the public is that the funds that we have are not being invested in the state, and that we ought, if we have confidence in our state, that we ought to be willing and able to invest in our state. So your testimony would indicate to me, and some of the comments you have about people not having skills, are you saying you have... Are you really saying to us that you don't have confidence in the business in this state to be a dependable businesses that could, 7% is not very much.
No, what I'm saying is I do have confidence in the board that's elected to take part to invest these funds, and therefore, you know, from my standpoint, if the board makes a decision to invest in the state, that's fine. You know, I think they certainly have the skills to determine if the presentation made to them is of good quality and in the best interest of the people that they represent.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone else has any questions for this testifier? Thank you very much. Next, we have Dennis Milhouse.
Can I get some water?
There's a cup. Yeah, there's right.
Yeah, you want some coffee?
No, oh, thank you.
You have one of those times when your tongue was sticking to your mouth.
Terrible.
Please try to keep your...
I'll keep it as brief as I can. My first name is Dennis Milhouse. My name is Dennis Milhouse. My address is 407 East Northern Lights, Anchorage, Alaska. My phone number is 274-7150. I am the owner of Trendsetters School of Beauty and Styling Salons. My exact title is just probably everything. I'd like to just speak in support of this bill. I really think it's really time that a lot of the money in Alaska gets reinvested in Alaska, and I've been here since 52, and I've ran my schools and salons since 72. I got caught in the big economic downturn of the late 80s, and I haven't recovered since then. I absolutely never lost a piece of property. I was never late on a payment of that I had with any of the banks. The bank that I was with failed. They sold me to some outfit, something like Household Finance out of California. They come up and told me that they now own my property and they wanted me to come up with $500,000, and if I couldn't come up with that to start, they're going to start foreclosing on me. But then they had another offer, just sign all these papers and we'll let you keep your property you've had for the past 20 years. And I felt like I had a gun against my head, and I went down and signed the papers, and I've... through this whole process to this day, I work 27 days to pay the rent. My interest rates are 12% at some properties, 14.5% at others. I try to get outside financing. I go to the banks that I've done business with for years. Nobody wants to let me off the hook. It's kind of a real complicated thing, is that, boy, your buildings, the buildings that you have, or the building you designed, we can't build that because of the economy. It just doesn't justify the square foot per building. So we try to scale it down. They said, geez, we'd really like to help you. This is a wonderful idea, and you're really strong, and you do good, but your land's worth more than your building, so you still can't do it. We're in a position that is terrible. of the bank that I was with, I was the only commercial customer they had that was paid up to date. I wasn't behind any. FDIC came in, took them away, and I bled and struggled to make my payments, as I still do. When it come down to trying to get a deal, I'm the only one they didn't deal with. People that hadn't paid their loans for 3 years, they wrote them off. They went to the people and said, hey, here's a deal. You pay us this and you can have your property back. Me, who was never behind a payment, they sold me for 20 cents on a dollar to some outside outfit, and I said, I was like groveling and whining and saying, why? Well, we got to give some good ones with some bad ones. They're taking a lot of bad ones. You're a good one. So I worked real hard, and I re-leveraged some more property, personal property that I have. And I tried to buy my way out of these guys. And I at that percentage, and we're never late, there ain't no way. They're not ever going to let me off the hook. Came down to I finally groveled. I had a good grovel, and I really worked at it because it was the truth. And I took them through, and I said, look at these buildings. They're falling down, and the banks won't loan me money. Everything's out of pocket. I'm exhausted now. Help me out. One guy stroked his beard and he said, well, maybe I can help you. Maybe I will help you. The other guy said, no, I heard this state's taking a right-of-way and you're losing your house or eminent domain. I already know how much you're getting. We want it. And I tell you, well, how do I replace my house if I give you all the money? Well, their partnership split up, and I guess the final insult is that they threw all these two guys that split all the units that they bought during the downturn up, and they drew me out of a hat. And that's what I ended up. That's where I'm at now. I hope you'd pass this bill so that people that live in Alaska, make their money in Alaska, can, you know, take some of the investment of Alaska and help them out. That's what I would ask for. And I've got a great pay record. I mean, I didn't run out like everybody else did because this is my home. I got nowhere to run to. And I would just hope that the state would, you know, loosen up on this and reinvest in the people in Alaska that really make this a great state. I don't really have any more other than please use your wisdom and support this bill. I think it's a good thing for not just guys like me. I think it's good for the whole state. Investing money in golf courses and Indian Springs and all that, hey, if you got to repo them, who knows what the property is? You guys, people live in Alaska, know the value of the property in Juneau, Anchorage, Fairbanks, and it's real easy to get a hold of because it's right here in your own state. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you for the water.
Gail Harbaugh.
Whoa. My name is Gail Harbaugh. My last name is spelled H-A-R-B-O. My address is 820 Red Pole Lane in Fairbanks, Alaska. My phone number is 457-7815, and I'm retired. While I sympathize with the last person's testimony, I think it's important that the board be allowed to invest the money in the best way possible to get the best return. That's what you and I do with our dollars. We want to get the best return. There's nothing in the current bill that prevents them from investing 7% or more than 7% in the state of Alaska now. So I would hope that you not allow this to go forward and that this not be attached to the bill, because I think right now the board has the authority to invest more than 7% if they feel that's a good investment, or less. But I would urge you to keep this amendment out and give the board flexibility. They are the experts. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Gary Bader.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Gary Bader. I'm chairman of the Alaska State Pension Investment Board. The Alaska Pension Investment Board is comprised of 8 members. 4 of them are elected by the beneficiaries, and 4 are appointed by the governor. 2 of our current appointed members were appointed by Governor Hickel and reappointed by Governor Knowles. This board has the interest of serving the best interest of the participants in the system. The participants in the system are the retirees, the potential beneficiaries, and the public entities that are participating in the system on behalf of their employees. The returns of the system are of vital interest to the employees' level of comfort that their retirement benefit will be there when they choose to receive it. And it's also important to the political subdivisions, who are assessed based upon the earnings of the fund. If the funds don't earn as much money as they should, the contribution rates of employers tend to go up over time. The when we invest for the benefit of the participants, I think it's important that we understand that we shouldn't be compelling the pension funds to invest in ventures that the private sector would not be comfortable in investing in. I think that's one of the criticisms that we often face in public service, is that we ought to do things more like the private sector. To me, the argument that the private sector isn't interested in these investments ought to be a clear warning that maybe the pension funds shouldn't be interested in them either. As it relates to Alaska brokers, the Pension Investment Board has set up a mechanism where all of the equity trades that are that take place on behalf of the pension board are reported to the brokers in Alaska. And they have the capabilities within their own firm of getting a recapture or some Alaska credit within their firm. But it's not up to the board to see to it that that the check goes directly to them. They have the capability. We have an interest in investing in Alaska. When we find investments that are of the proper quality and investment return that we think are in the best interest of the fund, we would do so. Lastly, I believe that there are ways that Alaska benefits from investment in Alaska. There is Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. There is ADA to make sure that investments are placed in areas of Alaska where there is a genuine need to invest public funds and stimulate the economy with public capital. Thank you very much.
Representative Porter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't see anything in the bill that says that 7% of the investment should go to improving investments. I just see that 7% of the investments should be brokered through local state brokerages, the investments that they might put the money in.
I was addressing the earlier testimony.
Anything else, wouldn't it?
No, this doesn't require it. It doesn't require investment in Alaska. But the earlier testimony inferred that there was a linkage between investment in Alaska and this bill.
I would assume that there is. A local investor would have a better knowledge of investments that are prudent in Alaska than somebody in New York. But I don't see anything in the bill that says that this is going to jeopardize money. Just thought I'd point that out.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. How much of your portfolio is invested in Alaska now?
We have a very small amount of our portfolio is invested in Alaska. There are some investments that were made several years ago that we still hold. We sold a lot of our mortgages to a banking industry in Alaska. I believe it was a bank that was a successful bidder on those mortgages. We do hold some real estate owned that has troubles with the property, but it's not a very large amount of our portfolio.
Follow up on that. Is that because the investments in Alaska are shakier, or that the return is not as good, or what is the reason that you wouldn't go locally?
Oh, I'm not saying that. I hope I'm not saying that.
That you haven't gone locally.
Our investment allocation, which is where we're trying to determine how much should go in each type of investment, is based upon what we think the risk characteristics of the fund ought to be, and they haven't called for a increased allocation in real estate or mortgages. So the other investments tend to be stocks and bonds, and consequently, they're not in-state investments in that sense of the word.
Representative Ogun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The way I read this, I have to associate myself with remarks from Representative Porter, that it simply increase the board's utilization of brokerage and investment firms that are based in Alaska or Alaskan owned. Is that correct? And then they can still make the calls to invest.
That's correct.
Wherever they want. It's simply more of a utilize a certain percentage of it for local firms. So we're not necessarily. It's not really how good are the investments for Alaska. I guess the question is how good are the investors? investment companies and brokerage firms in Alaska, and are they capable and competent enough to invest properly wherever that may be?
I think that question would probably be better put to our chief investment officer, who is further down in the agenda, who can talk to how the brokerage industry is structured and how that would work.
My question is, when you're looking for places to invest, what brokerage firms do you normally use?
The brokerage firm is ordinarily selected in terms of buying stocks by the investment manager that we have engaged to do that. The pension fund has directed some of the commissions to go through a mechanism where we recapture commissions on behalf of the fund. So there is, in effect, whatever profit there is on commissions, we have it come back to the fund as opposed to going into the investment manager or some other person's pocket.
So you're doing your own brokering?
We are using another broker, but we have arrangements where we can get some discounts. That doesn't cover the entire fund. That's just a...
Is that a local broker or a broker outside the state?
That is a broker outside the state. Is that not correct, Mr. Storr? Yes. Okay.
I think herein lies the problem. Is that by going over the state to someone that's outside, you're not the only place where we have this problem. And one of the things that I just have to say this, that one of the problems we're having in this state is to keep the money that we make here. If we could just keep the money that we make here, we wouldn't be having all the financial dilemmas that we're having right now. And the other second part of that problem, from my perspective, is that wherever I've traveled throughout the state, and we're talking about the economic issues of the state, I never fail to hear from the people that we don't invest our own money in Alaska. Is that telling Alaska that we have no faith in them? So I think that maintaining that 7% be brokered through Alaskan brokers is not an unreasonable request, and would certainly answer to some of that public concern out there. If there is nothing that is determined in that 7% walk through that is a good investment, then of course then you have a good excuse for not doing it. But if you don't try, how do you know that the good investment is out there? So that's my comment. Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Michael Kirk.
I'm Michael Kirk, M-I-C-H-A-E-L, period, K-I-R-K. My address is 1718 Evergreen Avenue, Juneau, Alaska. My phone number is 586-4318. My fax number is 586-4318 also. I'm a retired teacher, and I'm here on behalf of them, on behalf of all state employees, on behalf of all municipal employees, and on behalf of you. If I told you how to invest the money in the piggy bank of your children, you'd be outraged. If I came to special pleading on behalf of private businessmen who compete in the open market, because that's the tradition in this country, it's a free economy, and they come and plead and say, unless you lay the piggy bank of your kids, or unless I lay your life savings, you'd be outraged. There are no special privileges in this investment game. There is, however, in the Constitution of the state, a prudent investor clause, which the investment people of the state, and I follow them very carefully, I've been at many of their meetings, have carefully followed. And it was put there for a purpose. And you have sworn to support the Constitution, which includes that prudent investor clause. I have also followed approximately 250 to 300 corruption cases of pension funds, where the same kind of pleading has been made as you're hearing today. I love to see the money invested in the state, but not somebody else's money. You invest your own money, they invest their own money, and I'll be darned if they tell me how to invest my savings. I have passed on to you a letter that went to the Anchorage paper. This is the Alaska Journal of Commerce, where a truly outrageous article by a Mrs. Ward was written. You all have your copies in your file. I hope you read it. I also hope that you read my paper, copy to the paper, as it is called in Juneau, the little paper that's published weekly, and it will fill in where my testimony does not. I want to remind you one more time that the Constitution of the state has a prudent investor clause, and until you change that, you'll be violating your own constitution to which you have sworn your loyalty. Thank you.
Mr. Kirk, go ahead, Representative Porter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kirk, I understand your position, and the only thing that I would temper your position with is this. One, I'm a retired municipal employee, and so don't say you're talking for all of us. Second, the difference between your children's and my children's piggy banks and that trust fund is that you and I put all the money in the piggy banks. The state put more than 50% of the money into that trust fund, and the investment procedures are well within state policy and guideline. Imprudent investment most certainly is not. And as it was pointed out before, there's nothing in this bill that indicates that anyone should make an imprudent investment.
May I respond to that? Once again, the market finds its own center of gravity. And I have no objection if 100% were invested in it. But what you are being asked is to violate not only the law, but also to violate the very market that you supposedly believe in.
Well, I respectfully disagree with you being asked to violate the law.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Robert Storer.
Madam Chair, my name is Robert Storer. I'm the Chief Investment Officer with the Department of Revenue, and the Department of Revenue provides staff for the Alaska State Pension Investment Board. And I'm here to make a couple observations, but I'm here primarily to answer your questions. With that in mind, I was reading through the legislation yesterday afternoon, and I noticed something, and given the intent of this language, I thought I should bring this to the attention of the committee. And if I may quote, on page 2, number 10, when it discusses this change in the legislation, I'll go down to the, I'll start at the latter part of that second line, at the at least 7% of the brokerage and investment services that the board procures by contract, unless the board makes a written finding. Let's see, I started a little, I apologize. Let me just start at the beginning. Increase the board's utilization of a brokerage and investment services provided by persons located in the state to at least 7% of the brokerage investment services that the board procures by contract. Brokerage services are not procured by contracts. And given the intent of this legislation, I think that one should recognize that there probably some language change would be appropriate. The Alaska State Pension Investment Board accepted fiduciary responsibility on July 1, 1993 for the retirement funds. And in that context, the statute states that they must consider the status of the fund's investments and liabilities, determine the appropriate investment objectives, establish investment policies to achieve these objectives, and number 4, act only in regard to the best interests of the system's plan and beneficiaries. Now, the pension board is held to what's known as the prudent expert rule as they manage these assets. They're held to that standard. Now, if I can't quibble with the intent of this legislation, but and this is a generic statement that applies to this legislation or anything like that, and that's the fact that legislation that defines some investment criteria, in effect, defines investment policy. And therein is where I have a problem with this legislation. Not the intent, but the fact that it becomes a defining event for investment policy. The world is changing. Investment world has changed dramatically. I came up here 13 years ago, and the investment vehicles, what you can, what you should not do, have really changed dramatically in that time period. And so the only thing I would say that I would have a concern with is the fact that it makes some element of investment policy by definition, if you will. And I think that's the main point I wanted to make before this committee. If I may, since there were some questions that were asked about the brokerage and trading activity, maybe I'll try to address what I heard there. Now, it is correct that we do have a policy that tries to address the commitment that brokerage firms have made in Alaska. And we've done this, and we walk that balance between addressing the Alaskan entities and the best execution, which our managers contractually are required to do. And the way we do that, as was noted earlier, is we provide information. These brokerage, the money managers trade not just for us, but all the firms in large blocks of, it could be 100, 200,000 shares at a time. And if you're taken out of that block, it can have an effect on trading. So again, what we do is we provide information to the local firms on a quarterly basis, all the trade activity by trade date and with every manager, et cetera, and commission dollars. And we give them the vehicles to go back to recapture some of that money, if you will. Now, when you trade securities, there's really two entities within a brokerage firm. There's retail and there's institutional. And the institutional trading floors and desks are distinctly different from the retail entities. And as you would expect, all of our managers, and we use the large public funds, use the institutional level. Now, what is happening in the institutional market of the brokerage firms is not as unlike what is happening in the rest of corporate America. There's downsizing. We're not seeing expanded institutional desks. We're seeing fewer. Just last fall, I went to the retirement party for the last institutional sales coverage in Seattle, for example, that I know of. I know of no other institutional sales coverage from a national brokerage firm in Seattle. Over the last decade, there's been consolidation in where there might be an office in San Francisco and L.A. They're consolidating it to one or the other. I know organizations have shut down their Chicago offices. So the institutional sales coverage is actually contracting. With technology from effectiveness, and that's not a bad thing. Make no mistake about it, but it is an industry trend. And when you deal with retail versus institutional, I can't remember if I said it before, but you go to different trading arms, there's different direct access, et cetera, and that's an important distinction when you're dealing with large institutional funds. In the last, in terms of activity that we've done, 30% of all trades have, equity trades, have been through firms that have offices located in Alaska. That equates out to about $764,000 in commission dollars that were done through firms that have offices in Alaska. Did all of that money come back to Alaska? No. How much? I don't know. But I know it would not be all. And that's probably an important issue. With that, I'm here to entertain any questions the members of this committee might have.
Representative Green?
I don't want to get off in some sort of a hairy investment type of question and answer here, but
yes.
Could you help me out then? If we were to have the board go through a local broker to contact an institutional broker, would there be subsequent payments? They couldn't combine those so that the whatever the brokerage fee would be could be shared?
There is a point. Well, there's 2 points: how the trade goes, and then how the commission comes back. And do we have to lunch? And I don't want to go any. We have a conflict, and what we've actually done, we talked about the commission recapture program. I'll answer that aspect, getting the commission dollars back. What we've done is we've tried to do the balance. We have committed to a commission recapture program, which brings dollars back into the plan. Now, why don't we do this with Alaska firms? That was intentional, because if we did this with Alaska firms, then all the commission dollars would have to come back to us. And so by excluding them, we are advantaging them in this process. And
this is
so,
doublespeak.
No, I apologize. No, this is probably a trust me would be in that. And so, truly did it intentionally so that the maximum number of dollars would be available to two firms that have offices located in Alaska and not be in conflict with getting money back to the beneficiaries either. And there's two components, that explicit act, which says we want commission dollars back, versus the implied, where we are assisting in getting the money back. I hope I didn't wander too far afield.
That's fine, and I have a very short follow-up.
Okay.
Is it possible through institutional brokerage that the investor can direct, or is he pretty much saying, take my money and trust me, and trust you? Is there a way that we could still do some activity through the state whether it's through brokerage fees or not?
The answer to your question is yes, you can direct. There are implications when you do direct, and you have to know the impact when you direct, because there are market impacts. There's a lot of trading costs simply besides the commission dollars. What is the impact when you take it outside of the block trade? And when it is explicitly directed, it has to be in the best interest of the beneficiaries, and we do that by having the money come back to ourselves. Now, the other is in the best interest of the state of Alaska. It's in the best interest of a stronger financial community, if you will, and that's why we walk that line, best interest of the beneficiaries versus assisting and not do that. I hope I didn't wander too much. The institutional desks are distinctly different from the firms in Alaska, the office in Alaska.
Thank you.
Representative Porter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have a handle now on what percentage you're currently using for local investment brokers?
Yes, we do, Madam Chair. We do about 30. It's been consistent. We spot check, but we've found about 30% of our commission dollars are executed through firms that have offices located in Alaska. But they're not. And I want to make that it's a distinction. I'm not trying to talk around it. It's not directly through the offices in Alaska.
So that wouldn't mean that you've exceeded the 7% goal.
As this language applies, the answer would be zero because they are not executed. This wants the execution to go through Alaska. So in response to this language, it's zero.
So if I could follow up what you've said, if we have a firm such as Merrill Lynch, just as an example, and they have an office here and you're dealing with them in New York, then that's your qualification that, yes, they have an office here. And your other question to yourself, does that money actually come back to Alaska? You didn't say it didn't, but certainly it doesn't.
Madam Chair, definably, money comes back to Alaska in this program. How much is we cannot measure. It's a private industry. It's part of, we call it the intramurals of Merrill Lynch, if we can use that as the example, and we can't get involved in that. But we provide as much information as we can to assist the local firms with in getting as many commission dollars as they can back in that process. And it's my sense that it just depends on the relationship of the firms. I think some firms get a very high volume back, and other firms are less successful.
I guess that one of the things that I would like to say is I'm kind of embarrassed and also very disappointed that we're even dealing with this issue. But the testimony that we've heard from the pension board and from you yourself, mm-hmm. Tells me why. Mm-hmm. The public doesn't understand. I'm saying, say we didn't pass this bill and we agreed with your status that and the other gentleman that testified about this being his piggy bank and he wants it to be spent prudently, and I don't think there's anyone on this committee that would suggest that otherwise, that the investments ought to be prudent. But the NEA, who has been here, is a large group of people in the state. Are they willing to tell the public why they don't want to invest in Alaska? I mean, if everything was going right, we wouldn't have this problem because there would be a small percentage of that. I cannot believe that there isn't prudent investment and there isn't any kind of ability to deal with Alaskan firms. I fail to understand that there's jeopardizing 1 cent by doing that, that there isn't just as prudent advisors and so forth here in Alaska. So that's why I'm disappointed that we're even coming to this issue and then running into such broad rejection of the idea that we should even consider it. I just have to say, I can't tell you how frustrated I am with this process. So, you know, you don't have to respond, but that I just have to share with you how frustrated I feel on this issue.
I understand, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We have John Sire.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my first name is John. Last name is Cyr, C-Y-R. I live in Palmer, Alaska, 745-2015. I'm the Vice President of NEA Alaska. And you know, you're absolutely right. The NEA is opposed to being the people in the state of Alaska and the state of Alaska. They have an obligation, we believe, to get the best return that they possibly can for the fund for the state. And I believe that they have been prudent in doing that. And I think if you look at the solvency of those funds, that holds true. And the second thing, I think, though, is, and it's been raised, is the question of faith in Alaska. It seems to me that this bill is the antithesis of faith in Alaska, because if you have faith in Alaskan businesses and faith in Alaskan brokerage firms and faith in Alaskans, you don't legislate that you must use these. You let the free market economy determine that, and that if, in fact, those firms and those brokerage houses can compete and do offer to Alaskans the best return on their investment and the best thing for Alaskans, that they will rise to the top. Thank you.
I appreciate your concern on that and tend to agree with a lot of the statements that you have made. But it appears to me that there is at least 8 people that are going to be sure that that doesn't happen. That's the concern that we are at this table about today. And you're saying that the decisions that they've made are the prudent ones and the only prudent ones. And we disagree. We believe that there are other prudent decisions and that they're not giving that option. Now, I understand exactly what you're saying. I agree with what you've said. And I think we ought to let the market set the process. But I think that there is some bias. It's something we live with every day, is bias, and I think probably people in the legislative process understand bias more than anyone else. So I'm not saying bias is something that no one exists, nothing exists. But when we have a state's responsibility, we have a fiduciary responsibility too. And I think that that's why we have this. And if this wasn't happening, we wouldn't be here today. That's, you know, if this wasn't happening, and it's hard for me to believe that there isn't prudent investments. Prudent people to be dealing with. I just think they're being glossed over. So thank you very much for your testimony. Okay, we have on teleconference in Anchorage, Ray Ellis.
Morning. My name is Raymond Ellis. I'm a certified public accountant. My office is located at 1500 West 33rd Avenue, Suite 100. My phone number is 274-5537. I've been a certified public accountant practicing in Alaska for over 30 years. During this time, I've seen many ups and downs in the economy and also worked with many clients on their ability and opportunities to obtain financing. Over the last 10 years, financing has been very difficult to obtain. I will not go into client affairs, I'll mention some of my own functions as an investor in real estate. 1984, with several partners, we built an office building which was primarily owner-occupied. At that time, we were able to obtain ADA bonds for the financing through Alliance Bank. When Alliance went under, FDIC took over the bonds. At no time were we ever late with the payment. However, FDIC informed us that we had a choice of either buying back the bonds ourselves or they were going to sell them off as a part of a package. Went to several local institutions to find financing, somebody to buy the bonds or do financing. We were turned down time and again, even though we were never late on a payment and the building was basically owner-occupied. Finally, one bank stepped forward and bought the bonds, but required us to put up over $200,000 to bring the debt in line with their financial requirements, which meant that the note had to be paid off, fully amortized, over a 10-year term. There's no way that any project in this state can be on an amortized over a 10-year term if this will not pencil out. We were fortunate in that we were able to do so. I also own another piece of older property in Midtown Anchorage, which I'm trying to get refinanced in order to pay off a balloon payment that is due at the end of this year. This is not possible for a number of reasons, again, because of the 10-year financing or the high exorbitant interest rates that are required. Again, I must emphasize that most projects that many people have, my clients, they will not pencil out the current financing arrangements that are available to them within the state. I urge passage of this bill to open up more opportunities for these projects to go off the ground. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Scott Johannes?
Hi, my name is Scott Johannes. I'm a general contractor, and I do work throughout the state. The name of my company is Criterion General, 8221 Diamond Hook Drive. I'm here to testify just on the problems that I've had to deal with over the years on the financing throughout the state. It's Alaska, especially in the rural communities, is unique in that it's very hard to have comparable pricing and valuations for properties for banks to use in making their loans. So they generally go to some pretty stringent cash requirements, cash flow requirements that aren't dealt with on a standard thing. And you just heard that it's, you know, it's very hard to do a project 10 point out in 10 years, and even harder when you're scrutinized under these increased criteria. There's been several projects that I've been involved with that have come up to be built in villages or whatnot that were good projects, but because they didn't fall under standard financing criteria, the banks weren't willing to loan on them. And it's always been frustrating that the state puts lots of money in these rural places as state-funded projects, but can't seem to make access to funds for private development in there. There's a lot of people that want to put their own money and develop economic structures within the communities, and they can't get the financing to get them started. Pretty much all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. David Gottstein?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Gottstein. I'm the president of Dynamic Capital Management, an Alaskan-based investment advisory firm specializing in large capitalization equities. My address is 471 West 36th Avenue, Anchorage, 99503. I am in the market to manage other people's money for a fee. This includes government pension assets. On the surface, because I might gain materially from its passage, you might assume that I would be in favor of HB 345 as it is currently written. You would be very wrong. I am also a lifelong Alaskan and do not think the bill as written serves the residents of Alaska or would accomplish the goals intended. Even though the intent of the proposed legislation should gain wide approval within the state, the mechanism used is fundamentally flawed on a number of issues. With more focused analysis, a much better formula could be devised. As members of the legislature, you are charged with the difficult task of balancing your fiduciary obligations to control and to protect the pension and other assets of state government with your obligations. As citizens charged with the general welfare of your constituencies, you also want to seek the growth of employment opportunities for Alaska's residents. I believe the solution would be to adopt a legitimate prejudice to hire Alaska firms that can show that the bulk of their human resources, wherever possible, are located in Alaska, and that services are provided without materially sacrificing competency, performance, or competitiveness in the areas of fees, charges, or commissions. There are several reasons why a quota system would not establish a system of checks and balances to accomplish the goals of having a legitimate prejudice to hire Alaskan firms. For example, the legislation currently written establishes a quota system that could result in a disaster. It is important that the decision makers assigning contracts feel ownership in the outcome and performance of their decisions. By focusing the decision-making process on a mandate to hire Alaskans, state decision makers are forced to abdicate their primary responsibility as fund protectors to become that of job creators. If a bad performance ensues from one of the marginally qualified Alaskan contractors, fiduciaries cannot be held accountable because they were forced by statute to select from a limited pool. It would be better for all if competency did not have to take a back seat in the decision-making process. Can you imagine a standard so low that one is required to hire someone unless they are determined to be unqualified? Do you know what one calls the person who graduates last in his medical class? He or she is called doctor. This path is laced with potential lies. The second flaw lies within the language, not the intent. The language in part says services provided by persons located in the state. The potential problem here is that legally a person can be a human or an entity. A company with an office in Alaska with only an order taker might qualify even though personnel in other states are actually getting paid for the services. Brokerage services might appear to go through an Anchorage or Fairbanks office, but actually be credited to an institutional New York broker when determining commission income and bonuses. May I continue for a moment?
Yeah, we'll try to wrap up quickly, please.
Okay. There's also a human factor. It is obvious from the way the legislation is written that the drafters have given up on the state's bureaucracy's ability to contract services without a prejudice against local hire. They have no incentive to do so. They would rather go to Phoenix to check up on a money manager than Anchorage. Attempting to beat them into submission by expecting them to adopt a new agenda and to perform it appropriately and with enthusiasm is quite frankly naive. Perhaps a better approach would be to convince the procurement officers that Alaskan employment will be a secondary but a legitimate criteria in the selection process, rather than cramming a process down their throats that they don't believe in. Getting input from them on how to accomplish both goals simultaneously would yield better results. I believe the main challenge here is to devise the method whereby the state does not suffer from using local hire, but rather supports and fosters growth in an immature but potentially significant industry. Current requirements sometimes preclude the state from nurturing a promising financial services industry. Therefore, in part, we may have to deal with certain regulatory or policy issues that act to discriminate currently against local hire because of company size and age or amount of assets under management.
Mr. Gostine, I'm going to have to ask you to conclude. You make a final statement.
Well, let me just say that there are qualified people in the state, and with reference to the brokerage, as an investment advisor, we are usually directed with responsibility of hiring the brokers, and our responsibility is to make sure the client gets the best execution, the lowest price, and the best backroom office. I can tell you that I think it would be very likely if you put a policy in place that as an investment advisor, I could make sure that I deal with brokers who use local brokers, and the local brokers get most of the commissions. It's not right to say that because a broker in New York is going to get 3 cents out of 10 cents as opposed to 0 cents.
Mr. Gostine, I'm going to have to ask you to stop.
Thank you.
Bob Bell.
Morning.
Yeah, please try to confine your comments to 3 minutes, if you would, please.
I certainly will. Most of you know me as the assemblyman from South Anchorage, but I also make my living running an engineering firm here in Alaska and have so for 20-some years. I just wanted to make 2 points with you. First of all, three, actually. The Anchorage Assembly passed a resolution asking our financial officers to try to use local firms, brokerage firms, as much as possible. We passed that about 9 months ago, I believe. Second, using local versus national firms, and I'm going to use an analogy here that, having to do with banks. When I first started my firm back in 74, we went to a small local bank, People's Bank. The reason we did that is because we felt like a small local bank would respond to our needs better because they were part of the community and knew what it was like to run a business here. And during the recession that we had in 79 and 80, that bank really stuck by us. I mean, we went through some real tough times there, and they stuck with us. Then they were bought by Rainier Bank, and then they were bought by Security Bank, and then they were bought by Bank America. And we went into the recession of 85, and I found myself sitting in that bank's office dealing with decisions that were made in the lower 48 that they couldn't maintain our line of credit anymore, even though we'd never missed a payment. We'd paid all our fees. We'd been a good customer for 17 years. But their decision down south was that the service industry was too dangerous in Alaska, so they were calling our loans. I think that's a significant difference between local and a large outside firm. The local firm stuck with us. They knew what was going on in the state. They knew that we were a viable firm, whereas the large outside firm was making an impersonal decision in Los Angeles. The other thing to keep in mind is the profit. Where does the profit go? It's a local firm. The profit stays here and helps build the building that those guys are operating in, pay the janitors, pay the people that maintain the building, and pay local taxes. To use an outside brokerage firm, it goes to New York, where they build a building there, pay the janitor there, pay local taxes there. I think it's the two main points is that the local brokerages know better how to invest in Alaska and do so, and that we would keep the profits here. Thank you.
Thank you. We have one left in Anchorage, and before we go any further, we've been in this session for an hour. And as soon as we finish the testimony, we'll move on. I have been checking to see how many people are signed up to testify, and I know the next two bills, 383 and 371, this is the second time they've been up and the people have come forward to testify. According to my information that I have here, I have about four people lined up to testify on House Bill 383, 12 in Anchorage and looks like 9 here in Juneau wanting to testify on 371. We can keep this meeting going till about 10 or 15 after 12, I mean 10, which is as long as we can do that. And I think that what we'll do is we'll, because there are more people for 371, I'd like to be sure that they all get heard today, that we'll have 383 on Saturday instead of today. We'll roll it over till Saturday. So for those people who are here to testify on 383 and or online for 383, we will be hearing that first up on Saturday. So now go ahead. We have one more testifying on this bill in Anchorage. Mano Fry, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mano Fry, 2501 Commercial Drive here in Anchorage. And I am here today as a trustee for the Alaska Laborers Employers Retirement Fund. And I will have to tell you that our pension fund is a jointly trustee fund, Taft-Hartley Fund. There are 4 management trustees. There are 4 union trustees, and it certainly provides balance as far as decisions. We have as strict or stricter requirements, standards that we have to meet under ERISA, at least as high, if not higher, than the state investment board. And so I have to tell you that it's personally repugnant to me to have to be here to testify to urge the investment board legislatively to invest in Alaska. It's beyond my comprehension, I have to tell you, that they haven't at least met this standard already. We have a pension fund entirely funded by those laborers working for the 2 locals, one in Fairbanks and one here in Anchorage, that belong to the Laborers International Union of North America. Without any urging or legislation, we have always provided a funding level for investments in Alaska. We have been involved in investing in real estate, for instance, for many years. Our pension fund is about $400 million. And we have investment advisors, just like the state investment board. We've hired investment advisors primarily from outside the state, and we have made sure and directed them, as long as the investment opportunities were prudent, not imprudent. I just can't believe that we'd hear testimony about imprudent investments. I can't imagine anyone working for the state or involved in any kind of pension fund would want to go to jail for their investment advice. But we have directed our investment advisors, as long as they were prudent, to look at the Alaskan market, and we have invested in some of the principal real estate properties throughout this state. We also, and unfortunately, as good a job as AHFC and ADA do, and they do a tremendous job within their parameters, but unfortunately there are some gaps. You've heard testimony already about real estate and the commercial banks not allowing more than a 10-year time frame for some of the investment vehicles. Okay, and we're going to wrap her up here. There are opportunities in this state that would be prudent investment, and I would encourage the passage of this bill, if nothing else, to make sure that the investment board utilizes every vehicle they can, not just in the brokerage commissions, but in direct investment in this state. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you very much. That is the last one we have signed up to testify on this bill. And so we'll set this bill aside now, and we'll go on to House Bill 371. And the sponsor is here. Representative Brown. Go ahead. We have, before we got here, we've decided that we can keep this meeting going until about 10 or 15 minutes after 10, and I want to be sure that we hear everyone who has signed up to testify, so we'll just kind of move this along. So
thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate you making time in the schedule to take up this issue, which is both profound and emotional, and I think of great importance to many Alaskans. Madam Speaker, when I introduced, or Madam Chair, House Bill 371, the situation was somewhat different than it is today. At that time, I was seeking to make legal the opportunity for a terminally ill, competent adult who will die within a short time to receive the assistance of a doctor, of a physician, in ending life in a dignified manner. Since the introduction of this bill, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has recognized this constitutional right as a liberty interest to die with dignity for a certain group of adults, those who are terminally ill and competent. In your packet, Madam Chair, I believe the committee would find a summary of this Ninth Circuit decision prepared by Legislative Counsel Terry Lauterbach, who's the drafter of our bill. And she, in this memo, outlines the provisions of this decision, which are quite similar to the same situation that is set up in House Bill 371. I recognize there are many different points of view on this, and I'd like to emphasize that passage of this bill does not require anyone to do anything that does not fit with their own moral code, but it does allow people who have different moral codes to act in accordance with their own conscience and choose to end life rather than subject themselves to a prolonged and difficult death if they wish to do that. I think that it does make sense from both the perspective of opponents of this concept as well as supporters that our legislature should move forward and debate and establish appropriate proper safeguards so that this right can be exercised in a proper manner. I would characterize the situation as with this court decision having come down, it's now would be difficult, if not impossible, to prosecute a physician for participating in an act like this with the law having been declared unconstitutional. That was a Washington state law. The law is quite similar, or the words are identical, the words that were struck down, to what is found in Alaska law. So given that we're kind of in that gray no man's land, I believe the public interest is best served by setting those conditions so that it is free from coercion and so that all parties are protected. There is a sponsor statement on the back of it. It summarizes the safeguards in the law that I believe would be best to go ahead and establish at this time in Alaska law, recognizing the state of the legal situation. The person has to be terminally ill. The request for life-ending medication has to be in writing. A second consulting physician must then confirm both the diagnosis and the patient's mental competence. It has to be witnessed by individuals who have nothing to gain. The request must be made at least twice and no fewer than 10 days between the first and second request. The whole process is solely in the hands of the patient. Physicians and pharmacists have the absolute and unquestioned right to decline any involvement or participation. Hospitals also have the right to decline involvement. Institutions who are unwilling to proceed would have to take reasonable steps to transfer the patient to an institution that was willing to proceed or to his or her home. Madam Speaker, we've heard, Madam Chair, in this debate and the prior committee, which did spend a lot of time hearing from the public, there was many points of view. I'd like to bring to your attention that a recent poll showed there is very strong support among members in Anchorage, residents of Anchorage. I believe that material is also in your packet. About two-thirds of Anchorage voters said they supported this bill, either very likely to support it or somewhat likely to support it. Another 14% were very likely or somewhat likely to support it once they learned about the specific provisions and the safeguards in it. And I think there's overwhelming support and belief that people should have control over their own medical care and their own end-of-life decisions. And again, I'd urge you to think carefully about the benefits of moving forward and establishing the framework rather than leaving this matter solely in the hands of the courts and prosecuting attorneys. I think it is an appropriate area for legislative action. And I think this important constitutional right that's now been determined under the U.S. Constitution is even more likely to be present in Alaska with our strong privacy provision, which protects people in our own state. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you have. I'm abbreviating my remarks to give time that we might hear from the public.
Yeah, that's what I'd like to do. Thank you very much, Representative Brown. I would like to be sure these people have come out. This is not the first time they've come out. And I'd like to hear everyone's testimony, so give them special attention. We could go immediately to Anchorage, where there are a number of people online, and listen to their testimony. And I would say to all of those people that if they could be very brief, not more than 3 minutes, and please observe the three-minute timeline so I don't have to call you down. And we'll start with Sylvia Short.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak in this bill. My name is Sylvia Short. I don't really represent an organization. We are a loosely bound together group called Alaskans for Death with Dignity. My address is 705 West 47th. Kay has alluded to the Ninth Circuit Court decision in Compassion in Dying versus Washington and has told you that the statute struck down very closely parallels our statute in Alaska. As you know, the Ninth Circuit is in control of Alaska, that Alaska is bound by the decisions of that circuit as the law of the land because it is the federal court which has jurisdiction over constitutional questions implicating, of course, the national constitution. I'd like you to imagine with me a situation that would occur today in Alaska. A man is found dead. He had been under medical care for a terminal illness and was not expected to die for several months. After investigation, the district attorney charges the doctor with our statute, 8. The doctor defends that his actions fall within the exception of the Ninth Circuit. Now, of course, without our bill, HB 371, we have no guidelines, no safeguards for confirming the doctor's diagnosis or prognosis, the competence of the patient, whether the patient knew of alternate care available to him, whether or not the patient was coherent or competent, whether or not someone had forced him to make that decision. All of those things are subject to proof. They would have to be presented to the court. Let's suppose in the Kevorkian case, the doctor is acquitted. The state may then decide to appeal. The case goes to the state appellate court, the state Supreme Court convinced, into the federal court system. Meanwhile, since the standard of proof of a criminal matter is far stricter than that of a civil matter, a wrongful death civil case can be filed by relatives of the decedent. And again, the courts are confronted with a case without guidelines. Investigation could even reveal that it wasn't the doctor at all, but a well-meaning friend who acceded to the wishes of the dying man and procured the lethal medication. Although this does not fall within the terms of the narrow exception, another circuit court, the friend, relying on his analysis of the news stories, thought it was now perfectly safe to aid a suicide in Alaska, and there's nothing in our statutes to guide him. I commend this statute to you as the only way we can save ourselves from the needless costs of such court cases and from the possibility of people misinterpreting the court's decision and taking matters into their own hands. And I commend to you the poll that Lynn Simler has forwarded to you that was taken recently in March in Anchorage to show that the people support our bill. Thank you for your attention. Are there any questions?
No, ma'am. We'll go on to Al Sundquist, and let's please watch the three-minute time limit, please.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Al Sundquist, living at 3384 Mount Vernon Court, and thanking you for this opportunity. I strongly support the passage of House Bill 371. Today I want to point out the arbitrary structure of assisted suicide laws. To do this, I refer to the development of the Model Penal Code as reported in the Hastings Center Report of June 1993, and I quote, "The Model Code's reporters considered the argument that the criminality of assisted suicide should turn upon the presence of a selfish motive, but concluded that the wiser course was to maintain the prohibition and rely on mitigation in the sentence when the grounds for it appeared," end of quote. Can we really say that the so-called wiser course has served us well? The public says no by wide majorities. Doctors and lawyers increasingly concur. It's time for the acceptance of suicide on the compassionate motive. The report continues that under the stimulus of the Model Code, in the next 15 years, 8 states passed new laws specifically prohibiting assisted suicide, and 11 other jurisdictions revised their existing statutes. My other point comes from Archbishop Hurley's Compass column in the English Daily News of March 14th, and again I quote, "I have sat at the bedside of the dying, and I have heard the cries of those in extreme pain. I found myself praying to God for their speedy death. Assisting in a speedy death, when it is the suffering patient's pleading desire, is a humane and compassionate solution. Bishop Hurley's response may satisfy his followers and hospice caregivers, but it would not be my choice. Let me answer to my God in my own way. You and committee have the power to save me from the prayerful death solution. Please pass House Bill 371. Thank you again."
Thank you. Lynn Stimler.
Lynn Stimler, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union, Alaska affiliate. It's very clear from the Compassion Dying decision of March 6th from the Ninth Circuit that a competent, terminally ill person has a constitutional right to determine the time and manner of their death. An Alaskan physician charged under our statute now can defend against state prosecution by simply showing that the patient was competent, they made a voluntary decision, and by providing proof of terminal illness. This is a very important chance for the state legislature to develop boundaries of this new constitutional right to determine the time and manner of your own death. The state, under constitutional analysis, the state of Alaska must refrain from putting substantial or unjustifiable in the way of a terminally ill patient who wants their physician assistance in dying. The ACLU believes that CSHB 371 would pass constitutional muster under the Ninth Circuit analysis. So 371 is a responsible attempt to set limits and establish procedures for Alaskans suffering from terminal illnesses. For the legislature to do nothing now and to not pass this bill out of committee were to make it more difficult, or even as difficult as possible, for terminally ill patients to exercise their constitutional right, will foster a climate of uncertainty for physicians and patients dealing with terminal illnesses. My husband is a physician in this community, and many of our friends are physicians, and they're concerned about this new climate of this uncertainty that will be created unless the legislature lays out boundaries. The ACLU strongly urges the legislature to compassionately enact a reasonable framework, which is provided in House Bill 371, so that terminally ill, competent Alaskans may exercise the liberty interest that's been affirmed by the Ninth Circuit for a terminally ill, competent person to choose the time and manner of their own death with the assistance of a physician who's acting under state guidelines. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Janet Oakes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Janet Oakes, and I represent Providence Health System in Alaska. While preparing to testify before the House Health Committee earlier this year, I found this thought-provoking observation from an ethicist, Corrine Bailey. "My observation," she says, "is that in the U.S., people often cry there ought to be a law, as if that would settle the matter. Perhaps it reflects our aversion to struggling with difficult moral issues, and obviously this is a difficult moral issue. And probably just as obviously, the Sisters of Providence Health System in Alaska opposes House Bill 371. Our position, title, it is physician-assisted suicide. We oppose it because of our basic values of respect for the sacredness of life, compassionate care of dying and vulnerable persons. And I could go on with several things, but in the interest of time, we feel the growing public support is the result of several underlying fears about dying. First of all, fear of losing dignity and control in the process, fear of unrelieved pain, fear of being a burden to your family, and fear of abandonment by your family and friends. And as I said at that last testimony, the healthcare system has failed miserably in its support of dying persons.
management. And as a health system, Providence is aggressively promoting better pain management. Just as Saturday, for example, a group met to begin pushing for more pain management and education. It's primarily an education issue with our physicians and our medical schools and our own employees. And we're looking at ways where we can mandate that our own employees, before they begin work in our institution, understand what is available and what the parameters are for pain management, that you don't have to worry about addiction. We believe that advanced directives are an underutilized opportunity for end-of-life decisions, and as you probably know, that we honor those decisions and preferences made in accord with existing legal and ethical standards. We're concerned because we think this is a reflection of the American approach to things. We want a quick fix. And I'm sure you'll hear from others the experience in Holland where, after careful consideration, they moved to legislation like this. And through the years, it's quickly become overutilized and done without the request of the patient. In conclusion, we do see that and respect the rights of those who support the bill, but in this case, two rights collide. And this is where we have to look at the common good. So I guess basically I'd ask that you give us just a little time. Don't rush into this bill. We believe that pain management is improving every day. And in conclusion, I'd like to give one last quote from that ethicist. It's just said that laws are a powerful way for societies to tell their stories. Laws not only reflect our values, but shape our values. And it's important to ask what story we would be telling by a law that allows physician-assisted death. Thank you.
Thank you. Arthur Curtis?
Thank you. I'm Arthur Curtis. I'm a six-and-a-half-year resident of Anchorage at 1605 Sitka, number 203. I'm a minister. I pondered these questions of suffering and life and death. And I would first like to say that I think that even though hospitals and doctors try to control pain, the evidence is very clear that in certain cases that pain cannot be controlled to make life livable and endurable for people in the throes of an uncurable illness. I think the medical science is unlikely ever to find ways to make those last days endurable for the patient and the family, because some illnesses are so inevitably a torture chamber that force people to endure suffering for no apparent reason. I think the bill that we have before us, House Bill 371, establishes guidelines to make sure that nobody is forced into making decisions against their will. It offers rights. It does not take away rights. It does not condone murder. It is certainly not suicide in any usual meaning of the term. It is simply aid in hastening an inevitable death. And so I think this bill can be confidently passed by the legislature in the assurance that it allows every Alaskan to make decisions according to his or her religious and moral beliefs. Thank you.
Thank you. Otter Kent, or Kent Otter. Got that backwards.
My name is Kent Altura. I'm representing myself as a private citizen in support of this bill. I reside at 4010 Piper Street, Anchorage. I am coming in support of this bill from the perspective of my belief that it is an irony that I can be more merciful to my dog than I can be to myself. This bill enables my freedom of choice for myself and my own behalf. It enables your freedom of choice for yourself under these specified circumstances. It enables my doctor and your doctor to provide the necessary medical assistance to exercise our individual choice to die with dignity
when we and others agree that choice is a sensible option. The bill removes government restriction on your and my individual liberties in this regard. I do not see this as a moral issue. I don't see it as an issue of rights. I see it as an issue of freedom granted by our Constitution.
Thank you.
Finally, the law sets sensible and effective restrictions which preclude abuse, which are sensible and necessary. I have a great deal of personal and professional experience with dying and death of both people and animals. I've had my father, my mother, my brother-in-law, and a lifelong friend literally die in my arms. It impresses me that we all come into this world the same way, but there seems to be an infinite number of ways of leaving it, some better than others, and some definitely horrible. The majority of citizens support the concept underlying this bill. My experience as an owner of a pet cremation service confirms the widespread support for medically assisted death. Thousands, and I do not exaggerate, thousands of my clients have had to have their pets put down as an act of mercy. And it is routine for me to say to them, it's ironic that we can be more merciful to our pets than we are allowed to be for ourselves. And the typical answer is, amen, I wish if I were in those circumstances that I could choose to die at my own time and in my own way. This is not a matter of managing pain. The issue is managing the prospect of life in misery. Thank you for the allowing me to testify.
Thank you. Kent Woodman.
Kent Lee Woodman, an Alaskan for over 42 years. I am not here to discuss my personal problems with Lou Gehrig's disease, but to talk to you about the law and our duties to it, your duty and mine. The U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has just ruled that the Washington state law prohibiting physician-assisted end-of-life services to be unconstitutional. It was a whopping defeat for the opposition, an 8-3 vote. That 77-page decision is being studied in detail by lots of people, including Alaska's Attorney General. We are in the Ninth Circuit. Our AG has already issued instructions not to prosecute physicians under the Alaska statute because ours is similar enough to the Washington law and because the decision was so very specific in so many areas. Each and every argument presented in opposition to House Bill 371 to date was dealt with in specific detail in the Ninth's decision, and each has been set aside completely. Such items as the slippery slope argument was dismissed completely as a pertinent defense. The concept of the state having a stronger interest in preserving life than the individual has in selecting the time and manner of ending his or her own was resoundingly supportive of our position. If you do not now have a written opinion from the AG, I'm sure it will be forthcoming within a week. Perhaps the most supportive element in the entire document, however, is the one that I've honed in on from the outset. They said that though feelings run high and folks proclaim religious and moral persuasions, that such individuals or groups cannot impose their standards on others. Finally, the decision expressly states, tells states to have laws on the books, not case law, not court decisions, but laws on the books which set the parameters to protect against abuse. 371 is precisely that. Failure to pass this bill this session will result in some other bill the first session of the next legislature, and that one may not be as well crafted and may in fact be more onerous to the opposition than this excellent document. Alaskans for Death with Dignity just completed a professional survey, the results of which mirror those taken in the rest of the country. No matter how the questions are asked, if they are accurate and professionally designed, fully three-quarters of the population is in favor of the right to make personal end-of-life decisions and to have assistance from their physicians. And some of the remaining 25% say that even though they may not, they don't mind if we do. This wagon is moving down the trail with more and more momentum and with considerable public and absolute legal support. Those opposing it will be hard-pressed to explain to the majority of their constituents why they were not on board. So today, if my doctor responded to my request and prescribed a fatal dose for me, and if I otherwise qualified, was far enough along to meet the criteria, he probably would not be prosecuted. Probably would not.